Blog Talk Radio.
Fascinating. Now, what does this do and what bearing does this have on the likes of us? Well, it seems if I'm looking around and noticing there are some folks, and you and I might share this understanding, that would think that the world's going to hell in a handcart. But that's an old notion. That's thousands and thousands of years old. And it's, again, it's a calculation, isn't it? You determine that the world's going to hell, and somebody gleefully will show you the way, the prophet that will follow, will take you out of this purgatory, this angst, and show you a way of happiness. I think that's important. I think that's very important. At a time when we are faced with challenges, this woke culture being one of it, that's, we're revisiting that. That's nothing new. We might soon be getting over the startle effect, just that we make it up. I want to be a tree, so I'm a tree. I just say I'm a tree. So there's an anger behind it, though. There's an anger, and this kind of comment, this kind of mention, it is a triggering mechanism these days, as it always has been, always. This is nothing new. if we're looking at progress, the progress of 21st century is there. We can look at some of the extensions of some very good ideas that went on too long without the necessary humanist adjustments. In other words, they're good ideas, but we can't live with them. And some of them are great ideas, except we can't afford them. Climate change is a product of all of that. Great, great ideas. Everybody profits. Build a comfortable shelter. Feed yourself until you're a roly-poly old person. Go and play canasta or in the winter up here. Join the bowling league and dress your family in their finest toques and mittens. Except we can't afford it. All those microfibers in the water killing all the bloody aquatic life. Who knew? Well, you know, it's not his fault. It's not my fault. Well, yeah, it's not quite that simple. So we're going to have a lot of that, you know, fault finding and blaming and stuff like that. We don't elect very articulate politicians. Now, come on, you have to admit they are what they are, but we need them dumbed down. We need it all dumbed down. And they, you know, we need the type that instead of sitting back and looking at us and scratching their heads and saying, what the hell are you thinking? We like the type that will ball up their fists and have a little temper tantrum because that seems to be attractive to us. We're the puppet masters, my goodness, you know. and then we create this. It's like picking up an Agatha Christie murder mystery. You know, that's what we need. It's entertainment. And the consequences, well, we're never quite ready for that because we don't really get there when we're thinking this through. We really don't have those kind of discussions. Let's not to say everybody in the world doesn't know. There are places that do, and we know them. We know them, and we can talk about them very, very freely, but it's scary stuff to try and compare what we're doing and think, can we get there? Well, we're getting somewhere, and it's not always... It's not always being controlled there, brethren, not always. So the big challenge today, as I take in a deep breath, is there determinism, and is that the failing of consciousness? Is that the failing? Oh, Freemasonry is the vehicle, but it isn't consciousness. It's not reality. This is it bundles a lot of very important principles and values. But what the hell good are they? If you're not learning them, you don't know them, and you don't apply them. Even if you learn them and know them, walk around very proud with your calfskin books and designer gloves. What the hell good are those values if you don't put them into action? You're waiting to be told? Really? You need somebody to tell you you're thinking? This is where I put my left foot. Come on, now is a good time to show what you are made of. If you have values, show them. If you're thinking that this charade that you've been performing needs substance, you'll start to invest yourself very readily in these storylines, this mythology, this symbolic language that we have taught to us, exposed to in the libraries and laboratories of Freemasonry. It's not even good enough to fill your library, because in a lot of places, you ever been in a library where all the books are lined up and they're either color coded or the spines haven't been cracked, and they're in beautiful. There could be all the, you know, especially I drool when I see some of the classical literature and those lovely leather bound collections. Oh, just heaven. And the beautiful chair sitting there with the proper reading lamp. Oh, as I dream, eh? A dream. What good is any of that? Absolute good. It's not even like my friends, the lawyers, sitting there with a collection of tort law as a reminder of how many times they have to hit themselves on the foot with a hammer. Tort law. And you should get well compensated for going through that on our behalf. My goodness. And the collection sits there. Hopefully you never have to crack it. But if you do, it's unrepentant, the complexity. No, we're in a, it's always time. But now it's just a simple question. What the hell good are you if we're not demonstrating values? And, oh, is it only once in a while, or is it only toward people familiar? Well, we've been living with some mythology in Masonry for a while, and I think their goals or ideals that are important, ideals that we can strive to achieve. That's, at least for the likes of me, is one of the most important and wonderful aspects of Freemasonry, is this ability to strive and have targets that I'm not, you know, not conjuring out of my own imagination. But I'm not the most trusting son of a gun in the world. I trust what I see and what's consistent. I trust when I understand truth. I'm a rationalist, you would say. I don't trust authority unless it makes sense in the moment. So somebody walks around and never to assume that. I'm not obsequious. I'm not a sycophant. I am what I am, but I'm like a lot of other people who think this through. When it makes sense, it makes sense. Teach me the mechanics of doing that so that I can arrive at the sense of things. The psychology, teach me about the drives. Teach me about this mind brain. So I begin to understand the difference. Time, space, teach me about it so I can begin to understand the fabric of time, space, and my place in it and consciousness. Teach me the tools of critical thought, logic, reasoning. Teach me those things so I can decipher, I can take apart your propositions and examine for myself if there are logical flaws, not as a, oh, God. Don't you get tired of people who say, I disagree with you? Well, yeah, you have your own opinion. It's not about agreeing or disagreeing. It's like, it is, it just is. What's your point? You know, is it this, you know, testosterone-driven, muscular boyishness that we can never rid ourselves of? Oh, my Lord, can't we ever get over our adolescence? We have these tools available, and Masonry has talked about it, and he talks about it often in passing. These are things that we teach you. The seven liberal arts, these are things that we teach you. The assumption being that it's taught and that it's absorbed and that it's employed. The ideas, Masonry, it may enlist the conscious and subconscious. The symbols are all around us. Take a look at, I'm in a lodge that can't figure out the need for symbols and mnemonics, so unfortunately it's not doing well. But in many lodges, you'll see these pillars, unconscious and conscious. And when you unlock that, where does it take you? Where does it take you? It takes you to a capacity to understand and to realize there are some questions without answers. And now if you're really, really getting into it and it matters to you about truth and reality, if my telling you a story isn't working anymore. If you need something with a bit more gravitas than mythology, not to say, and remember here, I'm not saying that my Irish friends telling me tales of the fairies shouldn't be taken seriously, because they should. You should. No. It's you. It's on you, baby. It's on each and every one of us as individual minds. I wish that a good time and a handshake was enough to keep my thoughts healthy through all of this bleakness. But it doesn't. It doesn't. Not when I realize that the tap is running dry, the well's running dry, that the food that I'm putting on my table, that around our lively, to assist our lively conversations, are causing problems. And what do I have in exchange? The exchange, silly old men with silly temper tantrums, is assuming that they can control anything with their little tantrums, is getting a little bit tired. It's getting a little bit tired. And bloody hell, it's not enough to see us through this, is it? Not in the jurisdiction that I'm in. It's not enough. If it were, we wouldn't be in these straits, that we wouldn't be experiencing the challenges in the way we are. Astronomical. Maybe it's always that sense that, you know, that woke culture is in the mind, in the air. We've drank the Kool-Aid. The idea that this idea, this hasn't been enough. And now the value is just drained out of it like sand through our fingers. I don't know. I know it's not necessarily the practical solution. If I have to help my neighbor with some damage, or some, if there's flooding or they're hungry, that's very practical. But at the end of the day, I need something to look forward to strive, that gold ring, or what's the heaven for? You know, I need that. And if it wasn't there, yeah, I would be able to achieve that in my own mind. Yes, just like you would. You would find a reason to carry on. But is that too truthful, too frank? Yeah, I think it is for a lot of people, especially since we've been raised to live in little warrens, that in a culture that allows us to commit to deniability. I don't have to think about culpability as long as I can ignore. And I'm good at it. I have lots of distractions, materialism. Let me buy my happiness. Let me buy my, and not only that, let me overcome my sense of inadequacy by making my material achievement conspicuous. Who was it that wrote that wonderful theory on the notions on conspicuous consumption? The hell with that. The quantum is explaining to me that these suppositions about laws are probably not complete. Probably not enough. Oh, yeah. Don't forget, there will be people that will point out that unless they can see it, you know, the literalists, unless they can see it, doesn't exist. Well, how's that working for you? How's that working for you? All these folks are pretty damn unhappy and lost. And what a way to live a life. Eh? Angry? Angry? You know that these are folks that are not, it's not just when there's a microphone stuck in front of one of the Karens or one of the protesters, you know, somebody even sabotaged a microphone at a Remembrance Day service. It hurt my heart. But to react with a fist and a scream, that's what got us into this mess. The values of Masonry are not only prevalent, they are sustainable. And we're being tested. Oh, my goodness. Did you think that as we're making progress, as difficult as facing these moral challenges and learnings might be, that we're not going to be tested? There we go. For the love of everything right in the world, whatever that is, we have become brethren in an order that has not been completely defined yet. So sit back and maybe we'll continue this journey together, and we'll do some finding. I'm going to turn this over to a little bit of music just to help massage the mind just a touch. But I haven't done this for a while, and I want you to know who tunes in, so you can, as you're looking out at the stars, you can know that somebody's looking back. Ha ha! And this would be my also an expression of my gratitude for tuning in to Masonic Effects. Then they have listeners. Canada, you, the boys are phenomenal here. Thank you. In the U.S., my goodness, what is there, 51 Grand Lodges in the U.S.? Thank you for your support. Ireland, United Kingdom, Spain, yeah, been with us for a while, and Netherlands as well, and Germany. It's a pleasure. And I wonder if the airways carries the show into Bavaria. No. Far too developed and advanced, I would say. But hope springs eternal. And listeners from Turkey. Yes, hello. Beautiful country. Australia. Let's see how the resilience plays itself out in a place that knows a challenge. Yeah. And finally, from South America, Chile. We had listeners from Argentina for a little while, but you guys tuning in from Chile have kept us represented in an interesting part of the world. Anyway, I want you all to sit back, fill your mug or your chalice or your glass with the finest, with whatever makes you smile and makes you sigh and relax, whether it's a nice cup of tea or that coffee with that cardamom. Who makes this? You know, the one nice and thick and sweet. Or the other side of life, the Chardonnay I would want at least a Merlot and then if we're serious in our endeavors, a glass of scotch. Thank you for joining us. Check this out. This is Robert Clasper. I called this commentary generational. See what you think. What we learn about next generations is tough on conscience. Around the world, developed nations are experiencing serious trends, enveloped in what could arguably be called the greatest existential threat that will never be a headline. Before the eugenicists and authoritarians get overly excited and go no further, understanding why next generations have decided to live another life will be on the minds of those who notice such things. Why has birth rate continued to decline around the world? In Britain, in France, in Germany, in Japan, Russia, United States, Canada. We do not have enough children being born to maintain our current way of living. Truth. Why are so many young couples deciding not to have children? We don't have to go too far to find answers. More people in developed nations are living in poverty. People are dying from our negligence with water and air purity. Our politics has waved swords at multinationals, but otherwise decided not to bite the hand that feeds them. Suicide is escalating. The world feels unsafe and hostile. So why would we be judged responsible for the sins of our fathers? We are the generation known for stewardship at a time when extinction didn't matter. Think back. Think about the tobacco lobby, the effects of big pharma, and how we refuse to be inconvenienced by our cars tearing holes in the atmosphere. We're not wrong creatures. We learned the chemical signatures that killed us and collaborated with the owners in our way. So why wouldn't next generations assign blame to the generation who did nothing? That's the way they'll see it. It's the way they are seeing it. The children are unrepentant, telling us. Why wouldn't young men avoid organizations guilty of complacence before they were born? And why would we not want to bury our heads in the sand? We took what we wanted and told ourselves it wasn't on us. And we released an unrepentant international industry on the minds of the world's children. Is it time to listen? Of course it is. Of course it is. Can you decide? Is it too late? Good time for values, huh? Thank you. Interesting backstory on that song. You might want to take a look at it, make up your mind about a man very sick, still being brought to a microphone with his saxophone. Charlie Parker, a long time ago, and still with us today in a lot of ways. That's an interesting motif to keep in mind, isn't it? I'm talking, particularly with the kind of poetry that are bringing forward today. Thank God for poets and philosophers. You know, this is Socrates who said, you know, in life you can, if you marry the right woman, you'll be enormous. You'll be happy for the rest of your days. You'll enjoy life. And if you don't marry an angry woman, you become a philosopher. Socrates, what are you telling us here, buddy? There's messages all around. This is from the people that pay attention to the detail. Like you can blow a horn, you and I can blow a horn, but to make it an emotion, that's detail. This is the guy that the man that I'm talking about deserves our respect in some ways. I think John Donne, you may have heard of him. This is a guy born the 24th of January. Sometime between there and June 9th and 1572. So let's presume that literate people were reading his stuff. Let's presume that. He was a leading English poet. He died in 1631, 31st of March in London. So he made, lived and died close to home. And it's said the joy of this guy is the way he's referred to as the leading English poet of the metaphysical school. And he happened to be in another reality, the dean of St. Paul's Cathedral. That one. Yeah. Magnificent. Great vibe. Vibe in that place. Just, he's often considered the greatest love poet in the English language. I thought maybe Marlowe or what about that Shakespeare guy? But check this out for yourself. And it's just the is he able to write passionately or about passion, or does he capture passion? So this kind of part of the show, I share with all the people who in their real life, in their public existence, would never want anybody to think that they have this capability or sensitivity. I'm not talking about the brave hearts who actually write poetry and study it in universities around the world or in those high school classrooms. No. Or in the cafes in the Middle East where they regaled the audience with the tales, with poetry from the past. Can you imagine how beautiful that is? Yeah, I live in a place that's still so young, and yeah, I'm whining a little bit. We'll get there. And we do have some places like that, but not so much in the public yet. We're getting there. But this fellow was born just a little bit, to put this into some context. He was born a Roman Catholic. His mom was a descendant of Sir Thomas More's sister, as if that matters. Yeah. So we want to think that there would be trends and enrichments, just being part of those family. Just to, even if you were the slackard in the class, you would pick up quite a bit more than the person living in the streets of London at the time. But this first biographer, really, Isaac Walton, who said it, put it beautifully. This guy descended from a very ancient family in Wales and was a prosperous London merchant. So he did all right. He was little when his father died. That's not uncommon, is it, when I'm talking about poets and their backgrounds? Often they had a parent or both parents die, and they sort of bounced along that proverbial chip of wood on top of the torrent. And shortly after his dad died, his mom remarried, good for her, Dr. John Smyges, who raised the Dunn children. So at 12 years old, he matriculated at the University of Oxford. Those were the days, huh? Where he studied for 3 years. And then he most likely continued at Cambridge. This isn't a time where people were big on records. And if they were, you could imagine the amount of history between then and now, the keeping those records safe and not being bombed or burned or stolen or whatever, lost, misfiled, it would be remarkable. But while he was in those learned, rarefied atmosphere of academia, he took no degree because, as a Roman Catholic, he could not swear the required oath of allegiance to the Protestant Queen Elizabeth, which is necessary. So following his studies, Dunn probably traveled to Spain and Italy, and then he came back to read law in London. Smart. Let's just presume that he was a smart guy. And he did become, something notable. He was the secretary of Thomas Egerton, the Lord Keeper of the Seal. Influence. We're talking about influence here. But here, I'm going to share with you one of his poems. This is a poem he wrote on a wide range of satire and sermons and holy sonnets and elegies and love poems. And he's best known, perhaps, for the similarities between his erotic poetry and his religious poetry, as if there is a big difference when you're talking about passions. Eh? And much of his work, including this poem, The Sun Rising, was published after his death in 1633. And in this, there's a narrator. The speaker orders the sun to warm his bed so that he and his lover can stay there all day instead of getting up to go to work. it's been a long time since. You remember that, those days? It's not a work day. I'm just coffee, turn on some music. I'm comfortable, pull up the blankets. The poem's playful use of language and extended metaphor exemplifies Dunn's style. So here's what he says, and then we can all follow it together. This is, hey, son, you old disruptive busybody, why are you shining past the windows and closed curtains to pay an uninvited visit to me and my girlfriend? Do lovers really have to structure their schedules around your movements across the sky? You rude, inflexible, and insensitive jerk. Go school boys who are late to school or apprentices who are sulky about the early morning. Go tell the king's hunting party that the king is about to ride out on a hunt and urge lowly farm workers to start their harvesting duties. Love in all its forms is above the influence of season and weather and is also above the influence of hours and days and months, which, unlike love, wear out like old rags as time passes. Why should you think your beams are so worshipped and strong? I could block them out by closing my eyes, except that I wouldn't want to stop looking at my lover that long. Assuming that her eyes aren't so bright that they've blinded yours, go check, and tomorrow evening, tell me whether both the East Indies and West Indies, or where you left them, or whether they're right here next to me. Ask to see the king you saw yesterday, and you will hear that they are all lying here in this bed. My lover is every country, and I am every prince. Nothing else exists. By shining here on us, you can shine everywhere. Your bed is your center, and the bedroom walls are the outside boundaries of the solar system. He did it this way. Busy old fool, unruly son, why dost thou thus, through windows and through curtains, call on us? Must to thy motions lover's seasons run? Saucy, pedantic wench, go chide late schoolboys and sour apprentices. Go tell court huntsmen that the king will ride. Call country ants to harvest offices. Love, all alike, no season knows, nor clime, nor hours, days, months, which are the rags of time. Thy beam so revered and strong, why shouldst thou think? I could eclipse and cloud them with a wink, but that I would not lose sight of her so long, if her eyes had not blinded thine, look, and tomorrow late tell me whether both the Indies of spice and mine, but where thou hast left them, or lie here with me. Ask for those kings who thou saw yesterday, and thou shalt hear all here in one bed lie. She's all states and all princes. I nothing else is. Princes do not play us compared to this. Our honors mimic all wealth alchemy. Thou sin half as happy as we, in that the world's contracted thus, thine age asks ease, and since thy duties be to warm the world, that's done in warming us. Shine here to us, and thou art everywhere. This bed thy center is, these walls thy sphere. Long time ago. Thank you. Herbie Hancock, Freddie Hubbard, Dexter Gordon, Butch Warren, Billy Higgins, you know, those guys. I'm going to talk about, pick up history of masonry in Europe. And today we're talking about two periods. The period that we're talking about dangerous, depending, it had a danger that depended on what faith you carried with you, practiced. I don't think, it, like today, it didn't matter that you couldn't tell in theological terms what it was you were practicing, whether you were Anglican or Baptist or Anabaptist, you know, those fine lines. And most people today, it's the congregation and that sense of affiliation character that's enjoyed. We weren't any different about that, but we find that there were comparisons, and if you were think tribally here for a moment. Protestants in Edinburgh, for example, were connecting with Protestants in the Netherlands, particularly two towns we referred in the past couple of months to both Dundee and Nijmegen. I apologize to my Dutch in-laws for that. And they were essentially Protestant towns, and they enjoyed two of the highest literary rates in Western Europe. I heard you say. Yeah. And there were other similarities between the elite culture of the mid-18th century in Scotland and the Netherlands. The universities in Leiden and Edinburgh were also closely tied through their medical faculties. And the Dutch university having inspired much of the medical curriculum in Edinburgh. So there was an exchange. Scottish students often studied in Leiden. It costs being less than studying at home and staying at home, and Protestantism being regarded as safe for young minds.
Our seafaring Mason and his Dutch hosts would have communicated in French, the international language of the 18th century. French was so commonplace in the Dutch lodges that the first lodge in The Hague kept its records in both languages well into the 1750s. One elite lodge in Middelburg in Zeeland kept them in French right up until the 1780s. Rather quickly, our visitor would have discovered that the controversy engendered in Nijmegen by the exclusion of two Freemasons from the local church was no tempest in a provincial teapot. Fellowcraft, F.C. Merks and L.A. Merks, brothers by birth as well as by fraternizing, was the subject of Masonic discussion all over the Dutch Republic. Indeed, the Dominus Haverkamp, local Calvinist minister, had ensured that this would be the case. He had spoken from the pulpit against the fraternity, accusing it of godlessness, of putting the church in danger and of endangering the state, and even by its exclusion of women, of the darkest of debauchery. He's hinting at sodomy, eh? Homosexuality. Nice, real pious kind of guy, you know. We've had that through the history. And he made an accusation in particular. He accused the fraternity of playing a card game called in Dutch Duivelskaarten, devil's cards. And it's an 18th century version of tarot. These are quite serious and specific accusations. Mention of the devil's cards conjured up fortune-telling and magic and anti-clericalism. Yeah? The cards had been attacked frequently by both Protestant and Catholic clergy because the power attributed to them implied that fate and fortune, not divine providence, ruled over human affairs. Not least, they were frequently decorated with anti-clerical and sometimes lewd pictures. In the 1750s, one Amsterdam lodge imposed fines against excessive card playing. And we do not know if the Masons played with devil's cards. What is important is that the clergy thought they did. These rather remarkable accusations were advanced by a minister educated in Leiden. And they were targeted against known and there is no evidence to doubt, respected members of the community. The Merks brothers were the sons of the town's rent collector, and they were also in state service, civil servants. Eh? We are fortunate to be able to recreate something of the atmosphere of the ensuing controversy. Pamphlets were published by both sides and petitions to the civil and ecclesiastical authorities were filed by the Freemasons and their clerical detractors. Not to point out a distance between this kind of a story and us, this kind of a piece of history and us, but I think there are some takeaways here. Do we think that these kind of accusations have disappeared? I don't think so. The suspicions? Yeah, I don't think so. My goodness, I've met Masons suspicious of people that are well educated. Wow, we've come a short way in a long time, haven't we? What next?
time to be a thoughtful man. It's a good time to be sensitive to what's happening around us. It's a good time to try and make sense of it all, to come to some understanding. It's not easy. It's not meant to be easy. It's our lives and our sense of reality, where we put our alliances and our support does matter. Oh, we're not good puppet masters with politics, and we're not good students of setting up these large organizations. Politics and religion, big organizations fell apart, failed to meet the ideals. And is there any irony in that for Masonry? It's always been the case. We break it down and do your practice at a cellular level. It works, works, works. You're going to be a man of faith, a person that carrying on the narrative of politics, that community conversation that we need, absolutely need. Do that by yourself, with your closest friends, people that you trust. Oh, if you watch, you'll find out if they're friends. If they're friends, they'll listen to you. If they're not, they'll butt in with their own versions and change the subject. Every A campaign will become theirs. Every adventure will become less because they've had something more going on in their life. The true friend listens. There's certain truths in life. When we're imperfect. But as we begin to think, these peculiar thoughts, we might want to call philosophy, it helps us to understand. Helps us understand ourselves and the world around. If we don't, if we're caught up with emotion and we're making decisions based on anger and that search for bliss, not the Campbell kind of bliss, the euphoria. Even then, it's just that bearing and position, that context. You may not know what's coming next, but at least your feet will be on the ground. Your feet will be on the ground. And you'll know within yourself how to calculate, how to make sense of it all, how to do the math. Practice those, I urge you, gentlemen, practice those values. Bring them forward. Put your best foot forward, the bigger man, all of that type of thing. Not because I say it, but because you deserve it. My goodness, you certainly do. That's it for this week. I hope you'll consider tuning in with us again. I think we have something worthwhile to offer you. The music, if nothing else, is just it's beautiful. The poetry, if this leaves you in a certain frame of mind, good. Good. If it leaves you in a frame of mind that you judge to be better than when you started listening to the program, good. Good. And commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. Eh? Learning to do these things, be a good person anonymously is really, really quite a beautiful, beautiful exercise. I'll see you again. Thanks for sitting in with us today. Bye. Thank you.